We're recording. Hi, everybody. It's Anjali Reza Kolb here today. I am super excited to be talking with Mariam Rani and Chitra Ganesh about 9/11, and we're going to have a kind of meandering conversation, and one that is hoping to kind of highlight the intersections of our various works as New Yorkers, as people who have made our careers and lives like during this era. And so hopefully we will find those residences and bring them out. Everybody's going to introduce themselves. So maybe I'll just go last. Mariam, can you start?
Sure, I'm Mariam Ghani and I'm an artist, filmmaker, writer and teacher. And I collaborate with Chitra Ganesh on Index of the Disappeared.
Hi, I'm Chitra Ganesh. I'm a visual artist based in Brooklyn, born and raised in Brooklyn. And Mariam and I have worked on Index of the Disappeared since 2004.
And me, I'm Anjali Reza Kolb. I am a friend of the podcast and also happy to be a friend of Mariam, with whom I've had some conversations about contagion and race and pathology and the war on terror, and really delighted to be meeting Chitra, whose work I've admired for a long time today. My own scholarship is about Islamophobia and the disease poetics of empire, and my book is called Epidemic Empire, and I'm now working on some other stuff and writing things in general. These are sort of like previews, I guess, for the first question that I wanted us to talk about, which is, if you guys are open to it, just like some personal reflections. I'll get to the question of how 9/11 influenced your work and your course of study, and the decisions that you've made about the kind of questions and research that you want to pursue. But can we just begin with like, what do you feel about that day? Are there memories that stick with you that are important to talk about, or are we really talking about like legacy and after effects?
I mean, I think this is true for all of us, but I was in New York on 9/11, and yeah. I actually did see on television the second plane fly into the tower live. I was woken by a phone call from a friend who said, get up and turn on your television. And I turned it on and there was the second plane. And that day, many, many people came to my house and I cooked for all of them. And one person walked all the way from her job at the World Financial Center across the bridge to my house and arrived completely covered in ashes. She's one of my childhood friends who worked at the World Financial Center. And arrived covered in ashes and got into my shower. And then I gave her one of my dresses to wear. And at the time I actually worked for an artist who owned a building on Murray Street, right next to the World Trade Center. And so I remember going to work, you know, to my artist assistant job, on Murray Street just a few days after the towers fell, and you know, having to show ID and to show a letter from my employer to be able to get into the area. And then also, you know, the intense quality and the intense difficulty of breathing in this atmosphere that still was so full of dust and ash in that area. It hadn't yet dissipated even, you know, like a week afterwards. So yeah. I remember all of it very physically. And I, you know, I think it marked me as it marked many people in New York in a very physical way as an event.
Yeah, as you were talking, Mariam, I realized that I also had a viscerally related flood of memories that just came up to the surface. I mean, it's not something that I think about a lot, but it did activate many different things for me, just from also with my relationship with the city. So my mother used to work for the city and the housing department, and they had offices in the Twin Towers. So yeah. I've been there as a very little girl to visit her at work on the bring your kid to work day. And Spent a lot of time in Jersey City, so it's just was always in the horizon and in the skyline. I too, like Mariam, was in New York and was woken up to the sound of my roommate and her girlfriend screaming. It was going to be the first day of my second year of grad school, getting an MFA at Columbia. Mm-hmm. And then I too turned on the TV and saw what had happened. Other things that happened that day, which I remember, is I remember in one of the things I saw on TV, I saw people running, that iconic scene of people running mm-hmm. as the smoke was following them. And one of the people running was my friend Althea's brother, Omar Wasso. He was running from his office, and I just saw him there on television. Mm-hmm. That evening, my evening was really preoccupied with trying to find my father, who was working in Midtown at the United Bank for Africa, and who my stepmother was very worried about, and waiting somewhere for him on a park bench off of the Manhattan Bridge, and then going home and then waiting for him to, finally he came home. So that was really part of it too. And the atmosphere, absolutely. And also remembering another friend of mine whom we were cut off from because she lived in the East Village. And most of the rest of us were living in Brooklyn. I lived in Harlem at the time, and most other people were living in Prospect Heights. But I remember her not being able to leave that space for like 3 weeks or a month. And so there's just so many things that also are resonant for me in terms of the particularities and things that were my main preoccupations from 9/11. And that sort of also relate to this moment and the pandemic.
Yeah, I think also hearing you talk reminded me of how the cell phone network wasn't working on that day. Like everyone was trying to call everyone at the same time. And I was trying to reach my parents in DC and being totally unable to get through when they were unable to get through. And it was that panic that we all went into, being unable to call people.
Yeah. It's amazing. I did not expect to have new memories hearing you guys talk about your own day, like, because I've been asked about this so many times, I've thought about it so many times, but the like pat available version of the story was just like, I was in class, I was 19 when I came out of class between the first plane hitting and the second. And on campus, not only were everybody's cell phones down, but also the campus phones, which were called roam phones, weren't working. And so the just movement of bodies, like there were only a couple of pay phones left around and like in the blocks around campus. And that calling process took about 5 hours. Like everybody that I was coming out of class with, everybody was streaming out of campus trying to find a way to call or like figure out like which parent to call at work or like who, you know, like who's most likely to pick up their phone or, and my uncle lived on 106th Street. And the two memories I had that are new to me hearing you guys talk, are that I wound up that night at a bar, I think on 104th, that started like with a lot of grief, and ended with everyone in the bar extremely cheesily singing New York, New York, like standing on chairs, totally wasted. And it couldn't, like, if you saw that scene in a movie, you'd be like, oh, these like, this is incredibly corny. This would never happen. But like people, it was.
No, the mobilization of the local is so real.
Yeah.
Real. Yeah.
And I think we still didn't know where everybody was. Like my cousin lived below 14th Street. I think the cutoff was Houston. I also remember how drastically, I mean, I'd only lived here for 2 years, and how drastically my sense of geography changed. Like not only had I spent those 2 years orienting myself on the island in reference to the towers, but also Houston becoming like a no-go zone suddenly, and the way that the smoke like came uptown. It took hours, but it was blowing uptown. So you could like see what was happening before you could smell it. And then it was so intense once it wound up here.
Yeah. And the very quick securitization of the city was in one sense shocking, but then the other thing that happened to me at that time was I had actually just come back from a summer that I'd mostly spent in the Middle East. And I had actually been in the West Bank, and this was 2001. So I'd been in the West Bank, you know, right at the beginning of the Al-Aqsa Intifada. And I'd been, you know, crossing these extremely securitized borders, and I had been in places where there were bombings happening, and I had been in Lebanon and in Syria and in Jordan and in Turkey and Armenia. And I came back, and there was this, for me, there was this horrible feeling of inevitability about 9/11 that I did not share with a lot of people around me, but it just felt so horribly, horribly normal to me.
Unsurprising. Very, very unsurprising.
Because I had just spent 3 months in places where this was just what happened all the time, you know, where there was no expectation of safety, you know? And that was what was being shattered. And that was essentially what was shattered, you know, in the United States on 9/11 was the expectation of safety on American ground.
And I think that, I mean, one could argue that that was the beginning of a like continual shattering that we see now, where, you know, all of the expectations that one was supposed to be having a birthright to as an American citizen, like control over your water, over your weather, over your gas, like no one else had ever had, you know?
Yes.
And now that I feel like that was part of the trajectory to bringing us here.
Yes, and part of the reaction to it was the reaction in the form of, you know, the need to assert this kind of American imperial dominance over everywhere else, I think was about also trying to reassert this myth of American exceptionalism.
I've been thinking about this so much in terms of COVID space and pandemic space, like the totally aghast attitude that Americans are so good at expressing about like, oh my God, but we're part of the rest of the world. Like there was this forgetting that there was any continuity between the violent space of American imperialism outside and then life.
And I don't know if you, oh, sorry.
No, please, please.
I don't know if you talk about this in your book, Anjali, because I haven't read it yet. I really can't wait to read it. But I mean, part of in the space of now, you know, it's like part of it is also, I feel like there's some kind of inbuilt perception around whiteness that white bodies are not vectors of disease, you know? Right. So it's like, oh my God, we could actually be like spreading this, like not just be like, you know, under threat from Wuhan or whatever. Like, I think there was a similar inversion that had to happen where it was like, oh, we could actually be targeted rather than being like the kind of active violent agent.
Do you guys remember, I thought about this so much in the like weeks afterwards, but do you remember the discourse between the two planes when it flipped from this was an accident, like, oh my God, like, I don't know if you remember this, but when George W. Bush was informed when he was like in that second grade classroom of what happened, I think one of his staff members was like, a two engine prop plane like hit the World Trade Center, and both of them assumed that the pilot had like had a heart attack. Even that expectation that like if something catastrophic happens, it's certainly not because we're being targeted. And there was that weird interval between the two planes where the confusion just, it suspended that feeling of inviolability that is so very American, that a heart attack is more likely to have flown a plane into the World Trade Center. It was a very interesting gap, I feel like, that hermeneutic space between like something has happened and oh, we know what's happening.
And speaking of that hermeneutic space, I also feel like 9/11 was the beginning of certain shifts in media and also in like the semiotics of the media, like with multiple sort of news headlines and information happening at the same time. Like another thing I remember from that moment is the beginning of the scroll through and like the kind of information embedded within information.
Wait, so I'm just going to be audio person for a second and say you're doing some amazing hand gestures right now, but this is just going to be listening. So can you like describe, because that scroll, that's so vivid.
So one thing that you're remembering of the news narrative of that day reminds me of is how the events of 9/11 impacted and altered the visual structure of the news to include some of the things of how we consume information today. And by that, I'm thinking about having a news clip with a different kind of scrolling text on the bottom and another kind of text in the window, and having multiple screens happening within the television itself, which is more like the internet. So that's just another sort of shift that what you're talking about triggered me to think about.
That's mind blowing to me. I hadn't thought about that before, but now that you say it, it seems completely obvious and evident. Like when I think back on those, how TV looked different in that moment.
Or this scrolling fast thing.
Yeah, what? The continuous scroll. But it's interesting also because it was earlier that year in the coverage of what was happening in Palestine at that time that the New York Times first ran a video still as a front page photograph.
Oh,
and it was a video still of a body falling.
Oh.
Of a body falling, like a zoomed in still from Italian television.
Wow.
Of a body falling from the window of a Palestinian police station that was, you know, allegedly the body of an Israeli soldier, I believe. And you know, this was the first time that they'd ever used a still from video as a front page photograph. It was the first time they'd ever used a manipulated, like an obviously digitally manipulated still as very clearly.
Which reminds me of the footage, the fractional and incessant footage of quote unquote Palestinians celebrating on the streets was also intercut into the madness of trying to understand what 9/11 was, you know, which was something that people came back to just as a like flashpoint of calling bullshit on what happened.
Those juxtapositions, I wonder, I mean, this is, you guys are like real media theorists, but I wonder if those juxtapositions didn't give us a certain kind of, I don't know, like gateway drug experience to drone warfare. I mean, like what a visual or like videographed like mediation of the war was going to turn into or look like.
I mean, I would look
definitely
Gulf War. Huh? Like right. First Gulf War and then especially the second Gulf War, because those are the first wars that we really experience through gun camera footage that is broadcast unmediated on the nightly news. Right? And I remember this personally from the second Gulf War, but it certainly happened also during the first Gulf War. And, you know, multiple people have talked about this, Haroon Faruqi, Janan Alani, like, you know, talked about what it means to reproduce war rather than report on war, and how that shift kind of happened during the Gulf Wars, and what it has meant, you know, in terms of, you know, how we view the Middle East and the wars that happen in the Middle East and the kind of terra nullius, you know, that is implied by the view from the gun camera, right?
The arc that formed. Sorry, say that last part again, Maureen.
The land without people in it. What you see through the eye of a gun camera is a land that appears to be empty, that appears to have no people in it and no no culture in it, no history, right?
Just the ikdam mo settler colonial way of, you know, understanding a topography, right? So, but I think also how that...
There's a clear line from those images all the way back to, you know, the gun camera survey footage from World War One, which was then used, you know, was used in archaeological expeditions and all kinds of, settler colonial kind of...
And like with today, you know, and what Mariam is talking about, we're seeing like this sort of flashes of previous time and previous moment and previous representation, like, and a repetition of that.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. I think that's something that people were definitely looking to anchor it themselves with sort of history and repetition. In this moment, you know, which I think also was something that was sparked from the Kuwait War, the Gulf War, like September 11th.
Yeah, a lot of the history of I actually just gave a lecture on this in class. A lot of the history of media technology is a history of, you know, the attempt to develop ways to conduct war at a distance.
Right. Learning certain things, like for me, learning what that was about, because like, you know, growing up in New York, going regularly to India, reading other, like seeing other newspapers and periodicals from the rest of the world, I really did not know that it was forbidden to show a body on television. And so just even that sanitization of death, which is like, a persistent like specter of this moment right now as well, you know, like the sanitization of death through which we experience this moment of rupture was something that really struck me in terms of seeing the coffins coming covered and just thinking about another way that the U.S. sort of embodies its exceptionalism is how it deals with death and dying.
But it's only the sanitization of death and wounds and horror that happened to Americans.
Yeah. And then every other body just does not have the same weight or value.
Yes, no, the same dignity is never granted to other bodies. Yeah.
I can't remember if we talked about this, Mariam, but the U.S.'s handling of bin Laden's body, or at least what they said about it, was one of the most curious and perverse episodes in the early years of the war on terror, because unlike with the photographs of Saddam Hussein's sick and wounded body, there was this real like ethnography of the Middle East 101 understanding, where they were like, oh wait, like if there's a body, there can be a shrine. And so the reason given for quote unquote burying bin Laden's body at sea was precisely so there could be no like land-based grievable anchor, which I thought was incredibly fascinating and bizarre, given precisely what we're talking about, like all of that media training that made Americans not be able to imagine that a violent action could happen on our shores, because precisely it's been kept from our vision
using dignity to gaslight and erase, you know, the another level of the human cost. It's too much.
I mean, there is this like long history of burials at sea which it calls back to in an interesting way, right?
And on land, which are being activated because of the melting of permafrost. Like there is just something found in Finland, like all this burial of soldiers from the war. I'll be right back. I'm just going to get my cord. I realize.
Well, okay, while you get your cord. Okay, so we've been circling around the question that I wanted to, this is maybe too basic and maybe we want to just skip over it, but if it prompts anything, I have a kind of set of questions for me coming out of my like continued trying to understand the 9/11 Commission report. But I guess what I really I guess what I really want to say is, like, talk to me about some 9/11 texts. Like, what are the ones that piss you off the most? What are the, are there any that you think, and I mean this in a kind of expansive way, like, are there any snapshots or novels or like moments, maybe like the first video still, that appeared in a, on the front page of a newspaper, that feel, I don't know, worth talking about or like indelible to you? I'm partly asking this question because it feels for me as a critic, like, so I'm so desperate to escape it. And on the other hand, if I don't have an answer, like, the story just belongs to the 9/11 Commission report. I don't know. What do you have thoughts about this?
Yeah, there's one document that was really foundational for us in the index. At one point we did a project, this was actually 10 years ago for the Radical History Review's 10th anniversary 9/11 issue. We did a project where we kind of reflected on several foundational kind of documents in our archive. And the one that I think is really like the origin point of Index of the Disappeared is the special interest detention list.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. And so what that list is, putatively, is a list of the 700 odd men who were detained by the INS immediately after 9/11 as being, and then remanded to the FBI as being of special interest in relationship to the events of 9/11. And the first kind of information that was released publicly about these men was this list. And in the list, everything about these men was redacted except for their countries of origin.
Uh-huh.
Every other piece of information was redacted. That was the only thing that wasn't redacted. And it was just all these black blank spaces into which all the fears of the moment could be projected. And so, you know, for me, that was really the place where the project of Index of the Disappeared as an archive began. Was, you know, the project to understand, you know, what was in those blank spaces, what was being projected into them, and what was being concealed by them as well.
I want to return to that moment that Mariam was talking about, but I think that something really interesting about that and the legacy of that is how those experiences around special interest during September 11th motivated and shaped the way that undocumented people living in the US decided to move forward.
And yeah.
I remember being involved in community stuff, activism and stuff around the Muslim ban in 2017. And many of the people who were at the helm of that were talking about how the only reason they were here is because they hid and defied this special interest mandate. So it kind of underlines, like, it's like all the people who did not, who just refused to do that and who didn't apply.
Special registration,
huh?
Though, right? That's
what?
Special registration. That was special registration.
I'm so, oh, did I say special total COVID? Sorry. Let me repeat that. So
that the special registration was the like self-declaring,
self-reporting, which then led to people being indefinitely detained and deported on even very minor violations, like the failure to pay a parking ticket, the failure to pay like a student loan. I mean, it was quite a dragnet. And so therefore in 2017, when there was activism and efforts against the Muslim ban, a lot of that was citing that moment after September 11th of special registration as a proof that the government is not to be trusted and that one needs to work together on a grassroots level. So that was interesting. But I think that Mariam's point to really seeing, really being feeling the disjuncture between these blackened spaces and this kind of overwhelming flood of information or non-information was something that that inspired us to see what was behind that, what was being occluded.
Yeah.
I of course asked this question without having an answer to it, but you're both making me think, like, probably at least the image that's in my book that is that like fits alongside this and actually truly is for me representative of this moment is that, Mariam, I don't know if you remember this, but that redacted Freedom of Information Act document that the ACLU got, and everything on the page is redacted except the words waterboard.
Which
truly does feel like that is the defining image of these decades. And like, in fact, probably of 9/11, like I don't think I need to spell it out, but like there is zero information except waterboard.
We've seen a lot of things like that over the years. Yeah.
And I would say that I don't know if it was 9/11 or some of the other policies and wars that were evolved in the wake of 9/11, but I also feel like that was a moment at which some of this digitization of public records and documents began in the wake of 9/11, things that people assume and take for granted that would be very easy to access today, which were actually not available to a lay person who was not working behind the scenes at that time. And that was also part of what we had to activate our own networks and community for gathering some of that information, that kind of information that you would just kind of go over to ProPublica and pull it out now, that was not there then. So there was a actual, I guess, a different kind of physicality to the collection and the archiving that we were doing.
Yeah.
You can see it in the shift in redaction over these 20 years where things that were redacted, you know, in the early 2000s were all redacted by hand. Like you can see the mark of the hand that's wielding the Sharpie, and you know, things that are redacted in the 2010s are all redacted digitally.
And then there was also like, I wonder about it, but you know, there was also the introduction of redaction in white as a more standard way of redacting as well.
I wonder.
It's harder to decrypt digitally applied redaction when it's white on white, right? Than when it's black on white.
And it may be less visually jarring, I don't know.
It suggests an utterly different relationship to the information that is no longer behind, but simply like absent or like never.
Well, I think part of it came from this really large scale shift to secrecy where, you know, a single report would also have to go through maybe 8 different agencies for redaction.
Right.
You know, rather than just one person or 2 people. And instead a single report is actually being reviewed by 8 to 10 different agencies before it's released to the public.
I have yet another kind of naive just sort of naive question, but I'm thinking about what Chitra is saying about like the necessity, the actually just like differently physical act of gathering information in those first few years, and also what it felt like to like be in Seattle in 1999 and then in New York in 2003 for those protests. And I want to ask you guys, really without a thesis behind it, but like maybe this is a way of just getting to getting you to talk a little bit more about the question about like how did this shape your work, but like did we like learn to be activists in these years or like in those hours in new ways that we hadn't known before? Did it like require something of us? I mean, I certainly feel like it required something of me. I was also just at an age where that was like about to be possible. But yeah, I mean, I guess I'm asking, like, what did that event demand of you? And like, how did you negotiate it?
I think it required and invited people to be more sort of flexible and responsive in relation to the activism that happened. At least that was the case for me. I mean, prior to that, so I was 26. And so at that point, I had already participated, but my initial experiences of activism were kind of like being herded onto a bus and going to Washington, D.C. and marching in, you know, the big pro-choice march, the big gay march, whatever it was. But this felt a lot more, there were a lot more things that were kind of provisional and just started to happen, like autonomously ignited rather than carefully organized. And I think actually going to protest sit-ins, teach-ins, marches, any of that kind of stuff was a way that we gathered information. So that was part of the physicality of it. And also for our first project that we did together, which was presented at an artist-centered space called White Box, which at the time was in Chelsea and then moved to the Lower East Side, we were invited individually to reflect on or explore some kind of issue that was currently being excluded from mainstream electoral politics on the eve of the 2004 Republican National Convention. And that's when both of us were thinking individually about detention and deportation. But the formal structure and the physicality of how the works were made was very much in relation to both of our physical experiences in New York, like physically being confronted by the flyers, by the buildings, by the wreckage. And I think that it shaped both Mariam's video piece and how the legal fragments were assembled and stacked, and also my own window of flyers, kind of that was a counterpoint to missing victim flyers from the September 11th attack. So I would say that physically being in the space and having that experience in relation to body and scale also shaped that project.
Yeah, so at that time I had a studio in the Woolworth building through Lower Manhattan Cultural Council, which of course previously
was in the center.
Yeah, but my studio actually looked down on Ground Zero. You know, so it was hard not to think about it.
It's back to the very simple, like, material fact also of no cell phones. I'm recalling now that this was also the era during which, like, I learned to do jail support. Like, you didn't know where anyone was going, and doing jail support is precisely where you find out information, not the information that you're looking for necessarily. Mm-hmm. A very analog, like, there was this very analog moment that lasted for maybe another 5 years after.
Yeah, I feel that. Oh, sorry. Marian.
I mean, I wanted to kind of go back to the original question and just say that I think, you know, I'm a little younger than Chitran, but I'm older than you, Anjali. And I think I had already been very involved as an activist in some specific causes at that time. But I think what 9/11 did to my activism was converge it with my art in a way that had not previously happened, and converge it with different aspects of my practice in ways that hadn't, you know, previously been true. They had been more separate, not completely separate. Absolutely. Like, my politics and my art were never totally separate, but they were more separate before 9/11, and they became really intertwined afterwards. Like during the RNC, during the RNC, I was shooting video for the Lawyers Guild, like the entire RNC, and you know, it's like I was shooting video, like for the legal bank. Like, So it was like,
yeah, it became like that. Did you know it at the time? Were you like, I feel this tightening of like myself and my work, or are you able to say that now?
I think it was pretty clear to me at the time that that was happening, you know, for a lot of different reasons. I think, I don't know if I felt that I was steering it entirely or that it was more happening to me.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I would say exactly that. I mean, also for me, some of the things were incidental, but so therefore I feel like a certain set of conditions were arising and then we were adapting to meet them. I think that for me, there was a conscious shift, but what I will say is more surprising is the legacy and the way in which that experience of that moment, the early work we did, how all of those coalesced into certain kinds of methodologies that inform future like and current practices, you know, like Mariam's work that she's currently working on pandemics, and in fact many of her works, and in fact many of my projects, like a group of works looking at the visual language of protest, you know, and thinking about that. So that, and incidentally for me, one thing that happened is I wasn't able to go to my studio because I was at the time living with my girlfriend in Williamsburg and there was no train. So my practice shifted from painting large scale paintings in a canvas to making drawings on my kitchen table. Mm-hmm. And so that inflected how I worked in the index, but it also sort of paved a path to do large scale wall installation that I was definitely not steering to, you know.
When you moved out of painting.
These are details that I'm going to be obsessing about forever. I mean, that like the material conditions and the medium shift, of course, everybody's been thinking about this all through COVID, but I've never had a serious conversation, I don't think, about methodology, materials, scale, I guess the questions we were asking at that time. I like, Chitra, also thinking about I don't think this is what you were saying, but one of the things that I was sort of hearing in what you were saying is that there was a certain kind of layering that might've been like frozen for each of us in that moment that then turned into like multi-decade practices. And hearing you say that made me be like, oh, right. Like that was a moment when I was still pre-med and comp lit and like studying with Saeed and Spivak and like also thinking I was going to be like, of course my book is about like medicine and Orientalism. Like it could, because it was 2001 that I was like doing both of those things at the same time. It like, yeah.
Of course. Yeah. And yeah, I think it was just a rupture and a pivotal like turning point. And I think it was definitely, I see this in our work together, but also in Mariam and my practice as well, like looking for the kinds of narratives that lie beneath dominant tellings of really key moments of histories. Mm-hmm. Be they personal or sort of on a national
level. Mm-hmm. I mean, if 9/11 hadn't happened and then 10/7 hadn't happened, you know, I probably would have never gone back to Afghanistan. And that's, you know, that's a lot of work I wouldn't have made.
I'm on like on the verge of getting too sentimental about this, but it does seem worth saying, like it put a stop to, at least for me, the moment at which I could imagine having any kind of play space with a subjectivity that wasn't Muslim. Before I could imagine that. And
having any kind of what? Sorry, you
cut off. Like artistic space to play in.
Play space.
That had anything to do with like any aspect of my like creatureliness or observational, whatever. Like it just, it, that just wasn't possible afterwards. I mean, that was a different kind of shift, but I think you're, in some ways, Mariam, you're talking about a similar thing. Like you made different decisions about where you were going to spend your time and live your life. And
well, yes, I became very publicly Afghan. That was thrust upon me. Just because I was the only Afghan that everyone around me knew. And, you know, I did a performance about this in 2003, where I was sort of camped out at Exit Art in this replica of a CR tent. And I answered people's questions about Afghanistan for 4 hours every Saturday for 4 months. It was
an incredible piece. I so wish we had digital camera at that point, but I don't even think
I have photographs, but there's no video, unfortunately.
But they're probably like 400K videos.
I remember that. I forgot about that.
This is probably better for a lightning round question, but do you remember the worst question anyone asked you?
Well, people would actually come in and sit down on these cushions I had set up, and I was also serving people tea and World Food Program biscuits, which are like petit beurre crackers. Like people, like all the expats in Kabul used to hoard them because they were like some of the best food you could get in Kabul in those days. And I thought that was disgusting, which was the point of having them in the installations, because like it was basically only the expats who were eating them. Anyway, people would come in and they'd sit down in this installation and they would literally say, "Can you explain the Afghan Civil War to me?"
Yeah.
How long do you have? And people would actually just sit there for like an hour, hour and a half, you know, and like, let me explain the Afghan Civil War to them.
I mean, it's stomach dropping and also sort of beautiful.
Like it was sort of beautiful actually, in that people really wanted to know. They knew they didn't know and they wanted to know. And the thing that was,
and it's a question that just creates an impossible condition for the respondent.
I also didn't know very much in those days, so people would ask me questions I didn't know how to answer, because I was like, I've only been a public Afghan for like 2 months,
right?
Like I didn't know I'd have to do this.
Well, there was that compulsory expertise on Islam also, right? That you know, suddenly people had a lot of like just innocent, simple questions about extremely basic shit.
I'll just say like the importance of doing that performance for me was that it freed me from having to do it in my private life. Right? And I shifted it to being something that I also did online for 2 years. So literally people would ask me questions and I'd be like, ask it on the website.
Yeah.
Like
that's true. You know?
And people would actually just ask it on the website, which is great because then I'd only have to answer it once.
I would say that another thing that, I mean, not the worst question that someone asked me, it's kind of like a similar related responses, people being like, but you're Hindu, or oh, you're not Muslim. And I think that those kinds of statements were quite jarring for me because we grew up in New York City. My parents had Muslim friends because they grew up in Kolkata in the 60s in a secular India. So this kind of, marking this really dangerous and threatening way of marking.
Right, which is also a way of saying like, I have the right to, like, let me tell you how I'm going to classify you and also let you know that this is what I'm doing to every other brown person that I know.
Yeah, and also just realizing that, you know, realizing that I actually, my privilege for not being Muslim, in fact, or not having a Muslim name, a recognition that I carry with me now when I walk around India, you know, with a Pakka Brahmin name, like the idea of marking this and targeting this and surveilling this is also, it has this uneasy resonance with kind of the rise of Hindutvavadi, and anti-Muslim politics in India.
Yeah. I realize this is a huge can of worms, and I do want to get to like one other big question that I have for you both, but it does seem important to mark, like, we're also three non-men. And Mariam, I know that you have a brother, I have a brother, like, harassment distribution was certainly really different in these.
Oh, yeah.
And so there wasn't just a lot of policing of like white splaining of South Asian religious syncretism, but also really interesting, I think, responses on the basis of gender in public and in private spaces. What read as dangerous, what read as victimhood, it pulled out all different kinds of predictable, but really distressing responses from the white worlds that I lived in, at least. I won't speak for you guys, but white school, white neighborhood.
Yeah, I mean,
well, it definitely was a thing again where there was this really rhyming thing that happened where over like in the wake of September 11th and in the wake of the pandemic, I feared for my father, who was a very eccentric New Yorker. And I feared for his friendliness and how that would be read in a moment of extreme Islamophobia, but also for how his behavior would be apprehended and how he would be under threat as an elderly Asian person in the pandemic. So in these, both of these instances, like there was this kind of xenophobia that was already smoldering that then just like, oops, rose to the surface. And it was, you know, definitely your point to its targeting of South Asian and Muslim men is something that was really like a primary point of departure for our project.
Yes, and I have to say, and it is hard to say this right now with everything that I'm watching Afghan women go through in this moment, but it is always so much harder to convince white people to save Muslim men than Muslim women. So much harder.
Or to even recognize their humanity. I mean,
it's just it, and the difficulty of climbing that hill sometimes is
so painful.
The last 20 years where it has really killed me, and it is killing me right now. So
painful.
Yeah.
I mean, I think this kind of this imperial savior complex. I mean, you see this in conversations around like trafficking and migration.
We have to keep having this conversation every
time. I know.
But
what about the men who have to work for 20 hours a day and don't get any water? Oh, that's not sexy as a story. So we're not going to count that as part of our.
Or we just need them to build our campus in Abu Dhabi. So we're not going to mention them because that's not good for our PR. Okay.
Really encountering how this kind of how really drastic and harsh the scale of people mattering is just really, it's like brutal part of a work as well.
Mm-hmm. I kind of want to go off on a tangent about this woman who I think from Kansas, who was taking credit for rescuing the Afghan girls, data science team. But I think I'm going to ask you guys a serious question instead. And we can leave it if it's not interesting to you, but the question is about historicization and it's about periodization. And I wanna ask you both what you think about the very idea that there is a post 9/11 era, and further, like what kind of American myopia does that bespeak? And is it, Chitra, you were saying like before we got started that you wanted to say some stuff about education. Like I have a million angles at which I come from this question, but it seems to me both like absolutely compulsory to recognize a shift in global politics and specifically biopolitics in my own work post 9/11. But I also, I'm just curious, what do you think this functions like the interwar period? Like, what will we have said about this in the future? Does periodization help us in any way, like mark changes? I should have added this earlier, but like I'm specifically asking this in terms of the farther and farther and farther and farther reach of American Islamophobia, now as it is inflected in ways of thinking about Chinese Muslims, as it is inflected in ways of thinking about the BJP and its policies, right? So just that's the sort of context from which I'm asking it. But like, yeah, what does post 9/11 mean to you both?
I mean, do you remember when I interviewed you?
No, I was in a fugue state. I don't remember anything about that day.
When I interviewed you, I mentioned that post-pandemic is like post-internet or post-modern.
Right.
And that the pandemic will always be with us. And that's how I feel about post 9/11.
I agree. I feel like all of these, like the pandemic, 9/11, I think of it, when I visualize it, I feel like it's like the layers of archaeology in New York City. It's all there. They're all the, you know, we're living with all of it, in all of it at the same time. And I think that depending on the moment and what happens next and what supersedes this, it also informs which previous layers will get reactivated. You know, just like how we are thinking about 1919 and 1920 in New York now, how we were thinking about like certain moments in the 70s, et cetera. So
I actually do think 9/11 changed the world cataclysmically enough that post 9/11 names an era in which everything is and will always be inflected by 9/11. And
yes,
what followed it in the same way that post World War I is always yes. Post World War I and post World War II is always post World War II, and et cetera. Post internet is us all living in the condition of permanent internet and so on and so forth.
And like, the condition of permanent in a condition security of permanent, and travel, you know, like the way
permanent global war on terror now. That's yeah. Post 9/11.
Permanent okay. Over security and yeah. Like surveillance during international border crossing.
Permanent hyper classification. Like I don't see an end to these things coming. We're already at the 20-year mark of all of this stuff. I don't see it getting rolled back. Like,
and I think you can still see
Biden rolling it back. Like, changing administrations hasn't fixed any of it. Like,
no. And if the root of it is control of material resources, it's just, I mean, we are entering a period of crisis in which it's going to get nothing but worse.
Yes.
I appreciate
climate refugees coming. It is only yes. going to get worse. Yeah.
I appreciate, Chitra, though, the sense that there is this like sedimentation. It's like, it's reactivating continuities. At the same time, like whatever like dribble, drabble, drip of steroids US imperialism was on pre 9/11, it does seem historically different in the 20 years since.
Well, I think, yeah, I mean, I think a lot of those things that were developed slowly and in some cases, you know, behind the scenes are here to stay, like drone warfare, for example. Mm-hmm. You know, like that even further abstraction of the wiping out of lives and bodies is now here. I think we're it's sort of it's accumulating. It's now an accumulation of many afters that we're in.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the end of the war that wasn't an end.
Yeah, right. I mean, we're in the
and way. Cycles like Roe versus Wade. I mean, come the yeah. fuck on.
I want to let everybody go in a timely fashion. Shall we conclude with my provocative lightning round questions? Jethro has one also. So wait, just weave yours in a second. Freedom Tower, love it or hate it?
Hate it.
I feel very disconnected from it.
It doesn't make any sense.
It has no heart.
Everything that like freedom, whatever, it's always just none of us are free until all of us are free and all of us aren't free. So
I'm not.
Sorry, but all of this aren't free.
Yeah, freedom from what also is the question. Not true. I was hoping one of us would have a perverse affection for its like weird lavender hue, but I can't claim that. I don't have that affection.
Yeah. Well, I really,
I can't deal with things being named freedom something. Like, I just can't. it's just not a thing I can sit with, because it's like, we're not a country of the free. We're a country of the mass incarcerated. Like, it's not a country of freedom.
No,
Those things don't go together. Like, they are completely cognitively dissonant. So.
Yeah, much more to the point is Brian Stevenson's work around the Museum of African American History and Slavery. You know, yeah. It's like, that's what we need actually.
Yeah.
Is we need some actual depth and
knowledge,
substance of recognition.
Mm-hmm.
You guys took this lightning round question more seriously than I was even imagining.
I don't even remember.
Can we get a reparations tower? Amen.
I know. Or the museum, the 9/11 museum is a catastrophe, but I am in a weird way sort of fond of the memorial, like grief ditch. Has struck me as being like at least not the scariest place to be in New York. Mm. I think the rest of these are moot at this point. Chitra, do you have one? Do you have one good one?
I can't remember what it was. Like,
I was gonna ask you if you have a favorite like worst 9/11 memorabilia you've ever seen.
Oh. I don't know.
I saw a teddy bear in a Twin Tower vest.
Yes. Oh my God. I have actually seen that as well. Yes. I have totally seen that. And that's not great.
This conversation in fact came out of like a little side chat about the 9/11 industrial complex or the 9/11 nostalgia industrial complex that Sina and I were having a few months ago, which is why I asked that question. But I will leave you, I think, with my favorite 9/11 joke, which is the only 9/11 joke that anybody really knows. Mm-hmm. It is the knock, knock one. Knock, knock.
Who's there?
You said you'd never forget.
Oh, man. That's so bad.
I don't even
know. Oh, that was so good.